On this episode of Skeptico, near-death experience skeptic, Dr. G.M. Worley.
Ultimately, when you look at the total body of evidence explaining the physiological or biological basis of the near-death experience, the out-of-body experience, and the other experiences reported by those undergoing near-death experiences, you come to the conclusion that most of them, in fact all of them, can be explained by body function.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I have coming up an interesting interview with someone who's very skeptical of the near-death experience, and in particular, skeptical of the work of Dr. Jeffrey Long. Dr. Long, as many of you know, is a prominent near-death experience researcher, and he appeared on Skeptico a few episodes back to talk about his new book, Evidence of the Afterlife. So Dr. Worley, who we're going to hear from today, has written quite an extensive critique of that book and of the near-death experience in general. It's quite a long interview, and I also want to alert you to the fact that Dr. Long has agreed to come back on Skeptico and respond specifically to the points that Dr. Worley raises. So without anything further, let's hear from Dr. G.M. Worley. We're joined today by someone well qualified to enter into a discussion on the evidence of survival of consciousness and the near-death experience. Dr. G.M. Worley is a well-respected anesthesiologist in the Netherlands, a frequent lecturer in his field, and an author of three books, including Mortal Minds, The Biology of Near-Death Experiences. Dr. Worley, welcome to Skeptico.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here. I would like to add one other point, and that is that I've also written another book, and that is called The Unholy Legacy of Abraham, which uses the biology of near-death experiences and explains it rather more fully.
Great. And we might also point out that that second book that you mentioned is available as a free download to anyone. If I think that's correct, right?
That's correct.
And we'll have a link to that in the Skeptico show notes. So as well as a link to the article that we're going to talk mostly about today, and that's this critique that you offered to Dr. Jeffrey Long's book, Evidence of an Afterlife. That's what we're going to focus the main part of our discussion about today. And you've really written quite an extensive critique of that. And I thought it would be a great opportunity to have you on and get your perspective. So, you know, we have a lot of information I'd like to try and cover today between Dr. Long's book and your critique. There's quite a lot to sort through. So let me start by attempting to give a little bit of a big picture summary, and you can see if you think this is accurate or not.
Okay.
Great. So both you and Dr. Long have looked at the near-death experience phenomena at some depth, and Dr. Long thinks that his research and the research of other folks in the field is highly suggestive that consciousness somehow, in some way, survives death. In other words, he finds reason to believe these NDEers who think they've experienced what we all call an afterlife. And then you, on the other hand, believe that there's a more physiological explanation for what's going on. And you mainly focus on the hypothesis that NDEers are, in fact, conscious in a normal way through the faculties of their brain when they're having these experiences. Is that more or less correct?
Yeah, that's more or less correct. In fact, I've read the book of Jeffrey Long extensively, and also I'm very familiar with most other near-death experience research, and those are indeed my conclusions, that the persons undergoing a near-death experience are indeed undergoing a real experience. It's a profound experience. It even has sometimes a life-changing effect, and it's a real human experience. But I do not agree that the explanation is a supernatural or paranormal one. I believe these people are indeed conscious. But that brings us then to another subject of what is a near-death experience.
Yes. And, actually, before we even sort that out, let me lay the groundwork for how we're going to proceed, because what you did in your critique, which I thought was really good and helpful in terms of analyzing someone's, you know, claims, in this case, Dr. Long's claims, is you followed the format that he did. He lays out in his book 9 lines of evidence that he believes are highly suggestive of the near-death experience suggesting an afterlife, and then you go point by point. So that's how I thought we'd proceed here. And before we jump into those 9 lines, the first thing I guess I'd do is touch on something that you touched on in your introduction and just touched on real briefly there, and that is the research that Dr. Long has done. Because I think when I talk to some folks who are skeptical and maybe unfamiliar with the importance and the use of surveys in medical research, they may not be aware of, you know, how to look at this. Is survey really a valid way of looking at medical information? And then they have questions about whether this particular survey is 600 people looking at 600 cases, Dr. Long's research, you know, population, is that enough? And, you know, he had this questionnaire, it's 150 questions, pretty extensive, but is that enough? So what folks are telling me is that this kind of research, this kind of survey research with that kind of database, properly reviewed, properly constructed, is a reasonable way to kind of collect these accounts. Would you care to kind of weigh in on that at all?
I would indeed. The thing is that surveys are very powerful instruments, but they should be used very carefully. What you actually have in the case of Dr. Long is a good survey questionnaire, an extensive one. I've looked at it. But the problem is that the people who respond to it are the ones with a story to tell. So often the people with a story to tell will respond to these surveys, and people with less of a story or with no experience whatsoever, they will not respond at all to the survey. So what you actually have is a bias of the responders. And so in other words, it's like you send out a survey to 1,000 people, you get 400 replies back, completed surveys back, and you base your story on the 400 you've got that were returned. But the other 600, you've not heard nothing from them. So it depends on what sort of survey are you doing and what is the purpose of the survey. If you are just orienting yourself as to what is possibly going on, then a survey such as Dr. Long's is quite good in the sense that it will show you, these points are the ones we've got to look for and look at and examine. But it will not tell you any more than that.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm not sure how that will kind of play itself out in the content that we're going to talk about, but I think that's a point that we'll leave out there and leave on the table for further discussion. The other point that I want to bring up is something that you mentioned in the introduction to your critique, and that's this idea that Dr. Long is essentially arguing this God of the gaps argument. And in your article, you suggest that, you know, he's confronting scientific uncertainty, areas where we don't know what's going on, and he's maybe interjecting that with the presumption that, well, if there's a gap there, then God must be there.
Well, I'm not actually saying that it is God in this case, but the God of the gaps argument is a well-known theological argument commonly used by intelligent design people and creationists of all types, but it's also commonly used in science. And in fact, but in this particular case, I call it the God of the gaps argument because it's an argument familiar to most people. And in the case of Jeffrey Long, what he does in his book is he has 9 lines of evidence, as he calls them, and he tries, in some of them, to provide a scientific explanation, and then he cannot provide an explanation, so he says, yes, this is inexplicable, therefore the cause must be supernatural, or the cause must be that there really is an afterlife. And that's the system of argument consistently used throughout the book, in the examination of every one of these 9 lines.
Okay, so that'll be another point we'll just kind of leave on the side and let listeners decide, because you make a point there. I guess I would come back and say I didn't really read it that way. I mean, I read it as someone who was approaching a topic where there are admittedly a lot of gaps. I mean, when we get into the whole area of consciousness in general, let alone survival of consciousness, death, clinical death, and all the definitions we can go through that, we all realize there's a lot of gaps. So I think what he's tried to do is fill in those gaps the best he can with the best science that's available. And I think that you could make the argument that the other side, whatever that side is, you know, materialistic neuroscience or whatever, can be just as guilty of trying to fill in those gaps as well by saying, well, we don't know what's going on, but we'll figure it all out and it'll all map to neural correlates. I mean, that's also filling in the gaps. So I'm willing to leave the gaps be gaps and just say, what's the best evidence we have? And maybe that's all you're calling for too.
No, not quite the same way. The thing is that when I see a gap, I say, this is unknown. And okay, let's leave it at that at the moment and see if we can't approach the problem in a different way and also find a solution. Instead of saying, oh, there's a gap, therefore the explanation must be something quite different. There are many fields of physiology, chemistry, and in medicine where basically this type of gap does exist. And people then go on basically empirical explanations. But, and that is the difference between Geoffrey Long and my approach, and that I try and find an explanation. I keep puzzling and puzzling until, and that is what most skeptics or scientists will do, and not call it a gap which needs a different type of explanation altogether until you've actually exhausted all other possibilities. I do not find that Dr. Long does this.
Well, I would have to kind of take a point with that is that I do think you fill in those gaps when you say, we don't have any knowledge of this at this point, but we're going to discover it someday. I mean, these are these promissory notes that kind of get issued that said someday we're going to fill in this gap. So I think what he's doing is saying, here's from the empirical evidence that I have, here's the possible explanation, and it's sending us in a different direction in terms of theories that have to be played out, but he's looking at the evidence too. So I don't know. I can leave that alone for now. But if you have anything else to say about that, please go ahead.
Well, I think that basically he has looked at he has done some serious research. He has a large database of near-death experience reports, a very good one, I assume, because it's more than 1,300, 1,600, or whatever number of cases. It's large. And so he has a large database. But the problem is that In his book, he seems to accept these explanations at face value. The problem is that he does two things. One, he views the near-death experience as a unitary phenomenon. That means, regardless of the cause, the near-death experience is the same all the way around for all people. But when you look at near-death experience causes, you see, they arise during cardiac arrest, they arise during anesthesia, when there is absolutely no question of brain oxygen starvation, but only effects of drugs, cardiac arrest, you have drugs, brain oxygen starvation. They also arise during people who jump from the Golden Gate Bridge. And these people are certainly not oxygen starved and they are not under the effect of drugs. There have been interviews of survivors of these jumpers. There are also people with near-death experiences, basically due to fear. Fear of execution, fear of other things, or anxiety attacks. So the cause is very different. The final common pathway, as we call it in medicine and biochemistry, is the experience. And this is a profound experience with several characteristics. And these are what Dr. Long also refers to. So that's basically, so the near-death experience is not entirely the same thing. You've also got to look at the cause. And Dr. Long, he has a large database, and he fails to actually look at the cause, except in one particular case where he mentions that he studied near-death experiences during anesthesia and compared them to other near-death experiences. And he found that these people reported more darkness and tunnel experiences. Okay, and that was the only difference. I find this rather sad, actually, because Dr. Moody 1975, actually, 1973 was the first publication of his book, Life After Life, did also a very similar study, admittedly with far fewer patients, and came up with the same characteristics. So I found myself very disappointed in that, that regard.
I just actually see that as more evidence to support his conclusions. I mean, as you say, he has a large database. He's looked at many different cases with many different causes of the NDE. I'm not sure all the causes that you mentioned would really qualify as true NDEs, but leaving that aside for a minute, if we look at most of the ones you mentioned, I'm sure there'd be agreement there. But then the real question is, if we have all of these different causes, why would we expect to have such similarity in the experiences? But let's use that point as a jumping off point to jump into these 9 points, because I think it'll help structure what we're talking about.
Yep.
And the first point that you address is Dr. Long's contention that these patients experience a lucid death and that it's medically inexplicable to have a highly organized lucid experience while unconscious or clinically dead. So why don't you tell us your response to that?
Well, I'll begin by first talking about clinical death. Many people who talk about near-death experiences or write about them talk about the phenomenon of clinical death. What do they actually mean? Death is often, in many of these more simple books, defined as basically absence of breathing, absence of heartbeat, and in particular, absence of heartbeat. In fact, when you look at many of these things, the evidence that most people consider the hardest is the evidence of near-death experiences occurring during cardiac arrest. In that case, there is people have a demonstrated cardiac arrest. That means the heart has stopped beating or is beating so abnormally that it no longer pumps blood. Several good studies have been done of the speed at which consciousness is lost and the electrical activity of the brain ceases. And usually that this first good study was done in 1943 in an American prison by Lieutenant Colonel Rawson and a certain Cabot, and published in the Journal of Medical Mental and Science at the time. Good study. And then several more recent ones like Aminoff in the 80s with turning off pacemakers, also Visser in 2001. They all come to the same conclusion. Within 4 to 30 seconds, all electrical activity measurable as an electroencephalogram ceases. Okay. And Dr. Pim van Lommel, who performed one of the better studies, prospective studies of near-death experiences in the Netherlands with 300 and a bit numbers of patients, I can't remember the exact figure, he also stated the same in his article in The Lancet. What he then further forgot to say was the people that are interviewed after a cardiac arrest have all survived. In other words, they are alive to tell the tale. And why are they alive? Because they receive heart massage. Heart massage means that someone energetically presses on the chest to generate a sort of pumping action of the heart. Without heart massage, a person with a cardiac arrest simply is dead, very dead. And they do not come back to tell their story. So what you actually have is cardiac massage generates a flow of blood. This flow of blood has actually been measured in a number of studies, not many studies, and you have to look very carefully in all the scientific literature to find actually some studies where this actually was measured. And usually in around 20% of cases to about 40% of cases, enough blood flow is generated by cardiac massage to sustain consciousness. And I say potentially to sustain consciousness. That doesn't mean it automatically does. Then we come to the matter. So, and what people describe during cardiac, during their near-death experiences during cardiac massages, they saw the people working upon them, or they heard people rushing to them in the case that they were in a coronary care unit and their heart suddenly stopped pumping. Okay, they got 30 seconds to see, hear people running towards them, because they are conscious for these 30 seconds, and they can hear, even though they have no heartbeat. It's a commonly heard complaint from coronary care units, for example, where people suddenly the heartbeat of some people suddenly stops. They complain bitterly when they're jumped upon by whole piles of doctors and nurses and defibrillated, because they complain bitterly about the pain of the cardiac massage and also the pain of the defibrillation. Now, in fact, a lot of experiments in America and even medical practice in the United States with artificial hearts clearly demonstrates that heartbeat, or actual heartbeat, is not really needed for consciousness. Because, for example, in the Jewish hospital in Louisville in Kentucky, as well as in the LDH hospital in Arizona, as well as in several other large medical institutions where they do heart transplantations, some people are so sick, their hearts are so diseased, they cannot survive the period of waiting until a donor heart becomes available. So what is done in some cases is take out the old heart, put in a mechanical heart. It is just a machine to pump blood around, and you can take that to a battery-driven pneumatic unit, and the people can go home and live for a few months until a donor heart becomes available. This is standard practice in some places in the U.S. where enough money and facilities are available to provide this highly technical and medical service. So in other words, what you're actually doing with cardiac massage is something very similar. The heart is not beating, but you induce, due to heart massage, a pumping action which pumps blood around. Now, most people during heart massage or during a cardiac arrest are not at all and never attached to an electroencephalograph. That's very rare. In fact, most people, they fall down in the street or they suddenly have a heart attack in a ward or another place in the hospital. Electroencephalograph is never attached for the very simple reason it's very difficult to do that at the same time as someone's receiving heart massage. So, in fact, the presumption that all these people were flat-lined at the time is only a presumption. And, in fact, no one actually of these people in the research of Dr. Pim van Lommel or Sam Parnia and other people ever had an electroencephalograph machine attached to their heads. So the presumption of flat lining is purely an assumption because they remember, yes, electroencephalographic activity ceases after 4 to 30 seconds, and okay, in that case, they're flatlined, and they forget the action of the cardiac massage, which is to pump blood around the body.
Okay, a couple of points there. I mean, one, I think it's good that you remind us, which we often forget when we're talking about death, near death, that we're talking about the folks that come back to life. And I think that's a valid point.
Yeah.
But I still have a couple of pretty big problems with your argument. And the first is that the people who die, particularly those that have a heart attack, because it's easier to study because we know the physiology, well, they're not supposed to have the kind of experiences that Dr. Long found. I mean, one point that you just mentioned was pain.
Exactly.
Right? So in particular, these people complain about pain from the defibrillator, pain from people pounding on their chest. And yet, Dr. Long's survey finds that there isn't this pain. That doesn't appear at all, hardly at all in the surveys. And the other thing I guess I would just interject while we're talking about heart massage and that, and I don't know this, but one of my listeners contacted me and his sister, I think, is an emergency care nurse and said that, you know, really the most common procedure when someone is in hospital and has cardiac arrest is that defibrillator, you know, pounding on the chest is like secondary. The first thing to do is go over and zap them with the paddles, and that a lot of times the heart massage doesn't start for, it's kind of the last resort many minutes later. But all that leads back to this, what you're alluding to, and we really have to break it down, right? Because there's three parts to this process, particularly when we look at cardiac arrest. There's that 10 to 15 seconds between when the heart stops and the brain stops. And then there's, and we know, I mean, our best medical knowledge says that the brain is under a lot of stress, and it shouldn't be lucid and coherent during that time. And then the second part we have is when the brain is flatlined or dead, or we can assume, you know, nothing is happening, there hasn't been any attempt to resuscitate this person. And during that time, we definitely don't have any explanation for why they would have a conscious experience. And then the third part, as you are alluding to, and you mentioned, I think, quite rightly, that now we're getting blood flow back to the brain. So there is a chance for some conscious experience. But again, and again, I'm going to rely on you here, but doesn't our best medical knowledge tell us that, again, during that process of resuscitation, the brain coming back online after it's been dead, we wouldn't expect it to be lucid and coherent? I mean, isn't just the opposite the normal expectation of how that brain is working during that time?
Oh, they're all interesting problems, and in fact, they can be answered. To begin with, a person who has a cardiac arrest, they have a period or a short period of consciousness when they can hear people rushing to the bed if they're in a coronary care unit. And as you quite correctly say, in a coronary care unit, the first thing they do is defibrillate people. Out on the street or elsewhere in the hospital, they don't have this luxury, so they first do cardiac massage, and that is what most people undergo. Then we come to the point of, does cardiac massage, as I say, explain, does restore a flow of blood to the brain, but does this restore any electrical activity to the brain? That's an interesting question. And in fact, there are several studies which do show, and also case reports which do show that this is the case. What you actually have during a cardiac arrest is the blood flow to the brain stops. This means within seconds, the brain becomes oxygen starved. No one denies this. This is because the brain has actually no reserve store of oxygen. The brain becomes oxygen starved. And then when you have cardiac massage, there's a flow of blood is restored, sometimes sufficient to sustain consciousness. One study which was done by a patient where they actually had an EEG or an electroencephalograph. I'll use the longer term because the Americans use ECG instead of electroencephalograph, while in Europe we use EEG, so it's a bit confusing for many people. Anyway, so they actually had an electroencephalograph attached to the brain of this to the head of this person. He had a cardiac arrest. The electroencephalographic activity fell away as expected, and heart massage was applied, or cardiac massage, whatever you like to call it. And within 20 seconds after cardiac massage was instituted, electrical brain activity was restored. Similarly, other studies have been done with bispectral analysis apparatus. That's a method of a sort of integrated electroencephalograph used to monitor awareness during anesthesia. Some people have had this apparatus attached to their brain or to the head, basically, at the same during anesthesia, and during that period, they developed a cardiac arrest. During cardiac massage, bispectral activity reappeared. In other words, electroencephalographic activity reappeared. So, in fact, cardiac massage can restore electroencephalographic activity if applied efficiently. It will not occur in all people because not everyone is expert at applying cardiac massage, and not everyone has a chest which makes cardiac massage easy, and not everyone has enough broken ribs to make cardiac massage very effective.
And I guess that last part of what you're just saying there kind of brings me to the larger point, which you've cited some cases there, which you think are pretty good evidence that heart massage might regenerate conscious experience inside the brain. But don't we have to deal with the entirety of the data? We say we got a pretty good database here of near-death experiences. We have to try and explain as much of that as possible. So, you know, if you're right for 50% of the cases, and I don't think it's anywhere near that much, because I think we have other problems to overcome, like the symptoms of hypoxia, as you're kind of mentioning, should be present, and they're not present. The symptoms of when the brain is coming back online is normally a lot of confusion, maybe even amnesia. I mean, there's a lot of studies that suggest these are the normal symptoms. We don't see those. But let's say, take all that aside, and even say, let's say you're right, and your explanation accounts for 50% of the cases. Well, we still have a medical miracle here, even if you have only 50% of Dr. Long's 600 cases being unexplained. I guess, you know, it seems to me like there's a lot of wiggle room in his data, and there isn't a lot of wiggle room in your explanations. Your explanations have to account for all the cases.
Actually, it does. Because what you have is a difference between the observer and the experiencer. Now, The thing is that in Dr. Long's cases and in all other studies of near-death experiences during cardiac arrest, no one has actually any electroencephalographic data. They go on presumption. Therefore, you cannot say. We do know from the cases where people did have an electroencephalograph attached that they do, that electrical activity of the brain is restored with efficient cardiac massage. That is a fact. But then we come to the matter of the hypoxia or the oxygen starvation of the brain, as you would like to call, as I would rather express it, because that's a more easily understood term. Now, there have been many studies of oxygen starvation, and in fact, there's a very good book written by Van Leer and Stickney in from the Chicago University in 1963, and also the same studies, similar studies, and other ones have repeated the have confirmed the same phenomena, and that is one. If you observe a person who is oxygen starved, they look confused, dazed, they don't walk properly because of, in actual fact, it's not much. They're like these dazed mountaineers above 5,000 meters without oxygen. But the person undergoing this, they have two ways of experiencing it. Many people who undergo, and I refer to a colleague of mine, Professor Dahan, in the local University of Leiden, does experiments with hypoxia and oxygen drive and respiratory drive. Now, he administers oxygen-starved mixtures regularly to people, and he says, yeah, they look like rubbish, but they feel like heaven. They feel fantastic, and they feel more awake, aware, and everything like that. In fact, precisely what people describe during near-death experiences due to hypoxia. But hypoxia, as I say, is not the only explanation for near-death experiences. It certainly is with cardiac arrest, but not during anesthesia. Not during jumping from the Golden Gate Bridge or fear experiences.
Well, let's get into that. Let's get into anesthesia in just a minute. Before we leave this lucid experience part, and maybe we'll come back and touch on it later. You know,
I would add one thing to this lucid experience.
Yes,
it's very curious. But during extreme hypoxia or oxygen starvation of the brain, two senses are preserved. One is hearing, that remains preserved until you're unconscious, basically. So people, even though they're extremely oxygen starved, they can hear. Second, although the sense of body position, while this is abnormal, it is to a degree preserved. And these are the two things, but the sensation of pain or the sensation that pain is painful and unpleasant is lost. And that can be explained also with the physiology of oxygen starvation of the brain. But anyway, so you shouldn't eliminate hypoxia or oxygen starvation of the brain as an explanation, because people do, and many of them do, feel fantastic
right
during oxygen starvation of the brain. And they feel their senses are more acute, their hearing is better, and their perceptions are better, and their thoughts are more accurate and better and faster. So, in fact, that explains a great deal.
Okay, well, we still have two big problems in that time sequence, though, right? We have the problem after the 15 seconds when the brain does go flat, or we can, you know, you said we don't have these people hooked up to an EEG, so we don't know, but we can be pretty confident when they're having a cardiac arrest that within 20 seconds, their brain is flat, whether we have them hooked up to an EEG or not. And I'd go back and say, I'm not entirely sure that in every one of these cases, we don't have any EEG data, but I just don't know that. And it sounds like you're pretty confident that we don't. So I'll just leave that as an aside. But so we have these two other time frames that we have to worry about. One is when we know the brain, or we can reasonably assume that the brain is flat, and if there's any lucid experience during that time, we don't have any way of accounting for it. And then the third part is when the brain is coming back online, and as you just mentioned, we do have these other problems of confusion and pain and these other symptoms that are normally reported that aren't present at all in the data that we're working with in terms of Dr. Long. So we do need some kind of explanation to jive those two together, don't we?
No, Not really. The thing is that, one, with this business of cardiac arrest, there are near-death experiences where people describe themselves, boom, cardiac arrest, and they hear people saying around them saying, oh, he's fallen down, oh, cardiac arrest, etc., and they hear people running towards them. Then what most people describe is they describe themselves as looking down upon their bodies as their doctors are working upon them. In other words, they are actually undergoing cardiac massage at the time.
Okay, but let me just interject. So what if their experience includes a period of looking down at their body before they have cardiac massage, before they have defibrillation, before that? What about when they have that experience?
I have seldom come across a person or a near-death experience of a person who actually had a documented cardiac arrest, and in between, one, for they feeling themselves fading away, that they had an out-of-body experience or another experience where they saw nothing happening but just their body lying there.
Oh, no, there's plenty of those in Dr. Long's database. I mean, all the accounts are there online. Anyone can read it, but there's plenty of folks that said, you know, yeah, they experienced cardiac arrest and then they just saw their body flat, or they saw the line go flat on the EKG machine for an extended period of time, and then they saw them scrambling, or, you know, they'll say the whole thing. They saw everyone scrambling around in the thing and they didn't know what to do, and there was some confusion, and they wheeled in one cart and then they wheeled that out and then they had to wheel another one, and then so they go through the whole thing.
No doubt about that. The thing is that what he is describing is time dilation, which is something which can actually happen. And second, the fact that a person does not move during oxygen starvation does not automatically mean that they are unconscious. In fact, several studies have shown that during extreme, and also case reports during extreme hypoxia, just before a person loses consciousness due to oxygen starvation, they are paralyzed due to oxygen starvation, a phenomenon very similar to the locked-in syndrome, and I think the mechanism is more or less the same, they are paralyzed but conscious. Okay, so in that case, you don't need many seconds to have an experience.
But let's be clear, just so we're talking about the same thing. Your explanation has to fit in every case, and if we limit it to just talking about cardiac arrest because it's easier, then your explanation has to fit every cardiac arrest incident when we know, again, that there's no medical explanation for them having any conscious experience beyond 15 seconds, right? So isn't there a problem that they all the cases have to match up to your explanation?
Not at all. I don't see any problem at all. And in fact, I'm sure a good analysis will actually show this very point. The second thing is that not everyone of these people have a cardiac arrest has actually no cardiac output at the time. I have actually seen people during ventricular tachycardia, which is another abnormal heart rhythm, who actually have a reasonable blood pressure and everything else. So, and also, the anecdotes that you have or these stories, they do not entirely convince. And in fact, they don't convince at all, because some people may well have had a low cardiac output, and they see people rushing to them, and they see something on their monitor, but when did they see this? So I think my explanation accounts for most of it.
Okay. Well, let's move on, because we have a lot of ground to cover, and it's already very, very fascinating, and I like the way you come at these topics. It's very straightforward and with very solid kind of medical understanding of it. I think that really helps contribute to this whole discussion and this dialogue so that folks can figure this stuff out. So with that, let's go on to point two, which is the out-of-body experience. NDE ears see and hear the out-of-body state, and what they perceive is nearly always real. Okay, that's Dr. Long's assertion. Why don't you go ahead and tell us your response to that?
No, it's a nice question, actually. And in fact, it's a fascinating experience. It's also a real experience, there's no doubt about it. People really do feel themselves dissociated from their body, and they do really perceive themselves as looking down upon their body, etc. So there's no doubt about it. There's a real experience. In fact, what is very curious is when you look at it, the study and many of these reports of out-of-body experiences during cardiac arrest or other medical emergencies or whatever, they usually describe themselves as either floating above or standing at the same level as their body, and usually at a, separated by a distance of around 2-3 meters, something like that. In other words, 6 to 10 feet, something like that. Then, this is actually precisely what you would expect from most people with otoscopic experiences, as described by an old article, even in the 50s, 1957, if I remember, from a certain Dr. Luka Janowitz. But anyway, that's a nice thing. And he was talking about doppelgangers and other things. But anyway, then we're talking about these out-of-body experiences. What is very curious, and that's my big problem with this, is that many people describing their out-of-body experiences describe what they hear and what they see. This is amazing. Because when you're talking about an out-of-body experiences or a possible separated consciousness, a consciousness separate from the body and distant from the body, you're talking about something which is immaterial. In other words, this separated consciousness can pass through doors, can pass through walls, can even move out of the body without any sort of interaction with the material matter of the body. Yet, this separated consciousness can somehow hear pressure waves in air, which is very material. Yet the same separated consciousness did not interact with any solid material like the body as it left, or operating theater drapes, as in the case of Pam Reynolds and other people who have out-of-body experiences during surgery. And it can also see things. And it doesn't just see things, it sees things with light. Why do I say, and light is just basically another form of electromagnetic radiation, and it's the same sort of forces that bind molecules together, etc. And yet, moving out of the body, no interaction with these electromagnetic forces. Yet, it sees colors with light, and sees colors of clothing, it sees people, and the combination of these sounds and this sight, make up the veridical and the verifiable out-of-body experience reports. They hear people who are actually present at the time. They hear these people. They report also, yes, these things were said at the time. These things were seen at the time. These people wore this type of clothing. Yes, these people were there.
So what's your explanation then? Go ahead. I hear what you're saying. So your explanation for the OBE experience, collecting this data is...
Well, what you have actually is these people who observe, they see with light and they hear with sound. Otherwise, it wouldn't be verifiable. So in other words, what you actually have is these people, the separated, who are undergoing out-of-body experience, their separated consciousness is actually somehow interacting with light and sound, whereas before, it did not at all.
But Dr. Worley, isn't there a certain degree of kind of circular reasoning there? If we start with the assumption that we say, you know, you can't hear and you can't see without your brain and without interacting with the material world, and then we say, okay, so then we can assume that any account that describes hearing or seeing without the brain being present, therefore we should dismiss that account. I mean, how would we ever get out of that loop if we start with the presupposing that there isn't any possible way that the OB ear can really be seeing and hearing?
Well, there is one very simple way, and that is that the out-of-body experiencer is actually seeing and hearing with their body. They are hearing with their ears, and that means they can hear the sound. And they see with either their eyes in some cases, because their eyes are open, and so they can actually see people around them. And second, when you close your eyes, you can actually visualize, in your mind's eye, as it were, quite a lot of what is actually happening around you.
But again, that to me, that doesn't fit the data. I mean, it's an explanation out there, but when then we try and match it up with the data, it doesn't fit. And what I think the OBEers would immediately point out is that the biggest way it doesn't fit the data is that they're often bringing in data that they couldn't possibly see right inside the immediate vicinity, of down the hall of the hospital or on a different floor or miles away.
You're confusing two types of out-of-body experiences. One type of out-of-body experience in the vicinity of the person, and a second separated by a long distance from a person. To begin with, the person in the region of the person themselves, in their immediate vicinity, physical hearing and physical seeing, as well as building up an image in the mind's eye, will explain most of it. In fact, there's a very good out-of-body experience report by Dr. Pinval Wommel in his article in The Lancet, and in which he describes a man who fell down in a field near Nijmegen, which is in east of Holland, and was collected by the ambulance, brought back to the hospital, resuscitated. And during his resuscitation, he heard these people speaking and saying, shall we continue or not? And he tried telling them, I'm alive, I'm alive. No one heard him, of course. And keep on going. And no one heard him. But what he described was, he saw himself lying there. He saw themselves, these people resuscitating him. He could describe then a number of women and a number of men. And what he also described was, he described hearing, seeing, and also the pain of the resuscitation, because he was placed underneath a apparatus that's called a thumper. It's made by Michigan Instruments, and what that does is a sort of pneumatic ram, which does heart massage without any people being needed. It just is a sort of piston which bangs up and down, doing heart massage. And he described the pain from this. In other words, what this fellow was describing is actually hearing with his ears, because he could feel the pain of the heart massage continuing at the same time. This is one of the unusual reports. So for people in the vicinity, or in the immediate vicinity of a person undergoing heart massage for cardiac arrest or an out-of-body experience due to anything else, hearing and seeing and building up an image in the mind's eye of the person will describe this. As to distant out-of-body experiences where they make observations at a distance, there are anecdotal stories of these reports actually describing the reality at the time and what was seen and what was heard. However, when you examine these very carefully and actually look at the evidence piece by piece, you find that there are many inaccuracies, and in fact it does not always correspond all that well. It's a bit like people in the book of Geoffrey Long, where they meet deceased relatives, and they haven't recognized them. They don't know who these relatives are. So they go, when they arouse from their near-death experience, they go to old family photo albums, and they look through, and they say, hey, that's Aunt Tilly. Oh, that's Uncle Bob. I remember seeing him there. It's a bit like that.
Let's get into that later, because I think the family reunion, if we have time for it, is an interesting topic to bring up. I'd push back on a couple of points there about the OBE experience. One is your distinction between the near vicinity OBEs and the distant OBEs is a distinction that you're making. I don't know that Dr. Long makes that or that his research suggests any distinction. As a matter of fact, I think just the opposite. He doesn't see any difference in the accuracy of the data that comes back between the data that's from the vicinity and the data that's far away. Again, that's suggestive, I think, of his point. And also, even the data that's collected within the vicinity of the person who is dead at the time or unconscious at the time includes information that wouldn't normally be perceived by the senses. So again, I think what we really have to do, it demands that we really match the data that's been collected in this database that we both think is pretty strong, and we match the data statistically with what we would expect to find if your case is really true. And I don't think it is. And I guess I'd make one other point that I guess highlights that, and that's, you know, the whole process of CPR. I mean, if you look at folks who have had a near-death experience and remember something about the resuscitation process, and we'll leave aside whether that's because of, you know, increased blood flow to the brain or whatever. You had an NDE and you remember your resuscitation. The perspective that they remember it from is being out of their body. Now, if you go and ask people who are resuscitated, remember their resuscitation, didn't have an NDE, their perspective is not from an out-of-body experience. And so we wouldn't expect that. We wouldn't expect that there's this huge difference between people that experience this out-of-body experience, and it's directly related to whether they had an NDE.
Actually, it's a good question, and it's a very good point. What you actually are saying is that the out-of-body experience or near-death experience during a cardiac resuscitation is something unusual. And in fact, that is true. It only occurs in around 10% or even less of people who actually have a real, as defined by the criteria Ring or Grayson, who have a real near-death experience, as defined by them. That's an unusual thing. And you've always got to consider with this type of thing that any medical disorder, be it infectious or a circulatory arrest such as that, you have a standard set of manifestations, symptoms, experiences, and then you have a more unusual subset. And there's an old medical dictum or adage which says uncommon manifestations of common disorders occur far more frequently and are far more likely than common manifestations of uncommon disorders. And what you actually are describing here is something very similar to that. What you actually have is an unusual subset, but one which is also due to the same phenomenon of the cardiac arrest or other disorders. And in fact, this is what you have with near-death experiences during cardiac arrest. And in fact, the business of the out-of-body experience during these cardiac arrests is actually a problem of proprioception, because at the same time, you have abnormal function of the parietal lobe, abnormal function of whole areas of the brain, which induce actually all the symptoms of the person who describes a cardiac arrest.
That's an interesting point, and you brought it up in your critique that's online that we've linked to from the website. But I think there's something missing there. I mean, don't we have to show that there's some correlation there? If we take the whole population of people who have cardiac arrest, and then we say 10 to 15% of them have a near-death experience, and then we say, hey, you know what? Oh, by the way, 10 to 15% of them also have this increased blood flow to the brain. Well, those don't necessarily overlap 100%. We would have to somehow do some kind of study to show that there's some correlation just because the numbers are the same. And don't we have the same problem here? I mean, to assume that everyone who's being resuscitated is, because they had the out-of-body experience, must mean that they have some other set of physiological symptoms going on. Well, we don't have any evidence for that, do we?
Now, the problem is that there is very little. There are actually surprisingly few studies made of the flow of blood within the brain of a person undergoing cardiac massage for a cardiac arrest. And for obvious reasons, this is not done experimentally, inducing a cardiac arrest just to investigate this. Is not actually done experimentally. So in fact, most people, when they have a cardiac arrest, do that in all sorts of places where it is inconvenient to attach monitoring. And this is the big problem. The few places, situations where people have cardiac arrest and where monitoring was applied, they're not that common. So that's a big thing. Now, when you look at the studies of people undergoing cardiac arrest, for instance, I refer again to the good study of Pim von Lommel, and he finds, actually, that when you look at these studies, you find that only 24%, one quarter of the people who underwent a near-death experience, as defined as a near-death experience, during a cardiac arrest, actually had an out-of-body experience. The other three quarters did not.
Right, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. We can't really conclude much from that, can we?
No, but what I mean with this is very simply, what you have is that with a cardiac arrest and a near-death experience, the near-death experiences of these people undergoing cardiac arrests are not identical. Some will have, most will have a feeling of awareness of being dead or of ecstasy or serenity, etc., but only a quarter will actually have an out-of-body experience. Only a quarter will experience a tunnel. A quarter will have a light experience. They don't always all overlap. So it is not a unitary experience.
Well, but I think that's what the study that Dr. Long has kind of fleshes out in a really significant way. I mean, we can tear that data apart a million different ways, and he has. I mean, the tunnel part he excludes because they've just found over time that that isn't really a meaningful measure, but there's a bunch of other ones. I'll tell you what, I'm going to run out of your time here, and I want to use it as wisely as I can. So I'm going to push on to these other topics, and particularly want to get into anesthesia, which is your specialty, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But before we get there, let's touch on blind sight, because it's obviously something very dramatic, and that when we hear it in the media, it seems like a very profound, unexplainable medically kind of thing, and let's hear your explanation for it. So blind sight, NDEs take place among those that are blind, and these NDEs often include visual experiences. Your response to that?
That's also a fascinating phenomenon. I've read the book of Mind Sight very carefully. It's a fascinating book written by Kenneth Ring, a well-known near-death researcher, together with another female researcher, Sharon. I forget her surname. It's an interesting book, fascinating even. It reveals that people who are blind, and supposedly blind from birth as well, can actually have clear and even what appear to be visual near-death experiences. Now, I've looked through the book carefully. What he actually shows is something very fascinating. If you look at carefully at the stories of these people, I've cited a number of them on the critique of the book of Jeffrey Long, you find that many of them were actually not totally blind. They can see light, and some of them became blind. And even those who were blind from birth, they could distinguish between light and dark. And then we come to the matter of the experiences themselves. These are very clear experiences where they make good descriptions. But actually, what he doesn't actually prove is that this is true sight. Many mental blind people make extremely good mental maps of their surroundings. And this has been shown time and again in many psychological studies of blind people. And what is even more surprising is blind people can even make very good drawings of as if they are sighted, some of them. Some of them can even make good sculptures, very visual things. Thirdly, they can navigate through buildings quite accurately, even unknown places. So, in fact, they're very good at building mental maps and imagery, not quite the same as sight, but in the way they see things. So what they actually may be describing, and that doesn't really come out in that book of Ring and Sharon, what they may be describing is actually the way they see things rather than you or I see things. Another point is that they are inundated with visual imagery. So many of these things that they see or visualize in their mind's eye, as it were, are actually described in terms of color, because that's what they're used to. They hear it on the television, the radio, from other people. So you don't actually need to postulate that they actually see things in the same way. Another point with this book is a case where they describe a man who had been blind for 40 years, and he described the tie of someone else. Well, the thing is that this could not be verified at the time, because the person who was present at the time of the incident actually did not remember anything about it. So it's a book which raises questions, but does not answer any of them.
And this is a fascinating topic, and I think you're right to point out that we need to break this into two groups. One, people who were sighted at some point in their life and then became blind, and people who are blind from birth. But I have to kind of take issue with a couple of your points. Even if we accept at face value what you're saying, that some folks who are blind are better than sighted people at being able to form an image of a room or a mental map of things without using their sight, that still doesn't explain why they would present accounts that are just as accurate as cited people. It just doesn't. We wouldn't expect, even with their attuned faculties of hearing and touch, to be able to describe a room the same way a sighted person was. And the second point that you made, I really would take issue with. I'm not aware of, and maybe you can point me to any study that suggests that the imagery and the language that a blind person would use in describing a room would be rich with color and visual descriptions. I don't think that would be the case at all. So that takes that. It really deals with the folks who were sighted at some point in their life, but we have a much bigger problem to overcome when we talk about people who've never seen and have never experienced vision at any point in their life, because as we know in the studies that have been done of these folks, they don't even have a vocabulary or a means of talking about red or blue or yellow, because it's not within their experience at all. So I don't know. I think there's a huge burden to overcome in terms of explaining these many cases of folks who are blind and yet have visual experiences during an NDE.
No, it's a good point that you make, but there are actually several problems with that. One, these people are inundated with talk of color. And often when in a room, they hear people describing the colors of the walls, the furniture, the clothing, etc. So you cannot actually exclude from these reports of people making these near-death experience reports of contamination of their imagery with what they heard beforehand or during the experience themselves. Second, the book of Ring and Sharon is basically the only one I know of which actually describes near-death experiences among people who were blind or at birth and who were subsequently blinded. Thirdly, another matter with this book is there are some things which are very disputable or debatable therein, in that book. For instance, there is an interesting insert just before the last chapter where they say the person who reported these experiences was later found to have fabricated the whole story. But that's in a later edition of the book, the one I got when I ordered it from Amazon. So the thing is, I consider it a fascinating book, and he does raise some very interesting points, but he proves nothing.
Let's move on to the next point, your area of expertise, impossibly conscious. This is Dr. Long. NDEs occur during general anesthesia when no form of consciousness should be taking place.
Unfortunately, his opinion on this matter is very different to that of all anesthesiology societies throughout the world. Even the American Society of Anesthesiology recognizes that about 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 2,000 people under modern general anesthetic techniques can be conscious and are conscious. And in fact, there's a big problem which has been recognized since the 60s by all members of all societies of anesthesia. How do you tell whether a person is unconscious? There are several signs: increased pulse rate, increased blood pressure, sweating, pupil dilation. These days you've got electrical monitoring apparatus such as the BIS, apparatus from Advent Systems in France, which is a sort of integrated EEG. You can do brainstem evoked responses, like clicking in ears, as was done with this Pam Reynolds case, a primitive version at that time. And EEG monitoring, electroencephalographic monitoring, which tells you nothing, and such like. And in fact, these are very good monitors most of the time, but they are not 100% accurate. In fact, the American Society of Anesthesiology, along with many others, have provided a practice advisory for the use of electrical monitoring apparatus, which states, don't trust them 100%. Use your common sense and also other clinical signs together with these monitors, because sometimes they may indicate that a person is asleep, even when they are not. And in fact, I've had this experience several times in my career where, for example, a muscle paralysis monitor told me a person was paralyzed and they stood up. No, yeah, that's embarrassing, but it does happen. Yeah.
On one point I have to interject here is I don't see a huge gap between what you're saying here and what Dr. Long is saying. I mean, you're both saying that anesthesia awareness is very rare. I mean, he acknowledges that it happens, and I think he quotes the exact same stats that you do. You know, 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 1,000 people are experiencing it. So the question would be, why would we assume that it's any more common than that among NDEers?
No, it's not any more common than that. In fact, a near-death experience during anesthesia or an out-of-body experience during anesthesia, both of these are extremely rare occurrences. Several have been reported in 1975 in a study of the effects of muscle paralysis. Others have been reported since that time. They're unusual experiences. And in fact, some people during anesthesia are very aware and very awake. And even though they appear unconscious, I've had this happen a number of times. Luckily, they didn't feel any pain, but it is very upsetting when you hear that. But these people, during apparent unconsciousness, during anesthesia, where they don't look like they're conscious or don't give any manifestations, yet are conscious, what you do notice is the fact that they are affected by the drugs used during anesthesia. The same happens as well. A classic case is, as I cite, is Pam Reynolds' case, where before she was actually connected to any sort of bypass, she actually had heard the cardiothoracic surgeon talking about the fact that the arteries in her right groin were too small for the cardiac bypass tubing. Now, this was a conversation heard by other people in the room, therefore it was verifiable. Second, at the time, she felt no pain. Well, that's the effect of the fentanyl or morphine-like drugs they use to kill pain at the time. Thirdly, she felt calm and a bit unconcerned about all this. Okay, that's also an effect of opiates. Fourthly, she thought she knew beforehand she should have told the cardiothoracic surgeon about the size of her, the artery in her right groin being too small for the tubing. Strange. I don't know the size of my arteries either. But anyway, aside from that, what you see in this...
Just let's point out here that this Pam Reynolds case isn't a part of Dr. Long's research, right?
Oh, I know. But what he does report is that many people have a clear consciousness.
But again, I just want to bring you back to this one point, and then I want you to go on and please finish. But so I think he has 23 cases of people under general anesthesia that have an NDE. If the odds are 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 that someone would have anesthesia awareness, then of those 23 cases, it would be, chances are less than one of them was experiencing anesthesia awareness. Why would we assume that a large percentage of those folks are aware under general anesthesia?
A large proportion of people are not aware during anesthesia. In fact, what happens is that even if people are aware during anesthesia, they often forget it at the end.
I'm sorry, but it seems like that's the assumption you're making. You're assuming that the 23 people reported in Dr. Long's study who were under general anesthesia were all somehow aware, you know, were experiencing this problem that anesthesiologists have of anesthesia awareness. I mean, if half of those people, so again, the odds are 1 in 10,000, but let's say in this case, by some fluke that we don't understand, 50% of them were aware. Well, then we still have 50% of them, you know, a dozen people that we don't have that explanation for.
Well, the thing is, I don't agree with you on that point. The thing is, what he describes, experiences, unusual near-death experiences of people who were under general anesthesia at the time. In other words, these people, and it's a very rare experience, I quite agree, these people had an experience. And during this experience, they either had a out-of-body experience or they felt that their mental activity was clearer and more rapid than normal, or they felt ecstatic, etc. And now, these experiences or these effects can also be described by the effects of the drugs used during anesthesia. So I see no real problem with people having near-death experiences during anesthesia.
I was just going to interject here, and I want to get your response to this, but the tiny bit of knowledge that I have on this from a cursory examination says that the symptoms of anesthesia awareness, you know, are not present in Dr. Long's accounts. I mean, the confusion, even the euphoria in the hallucination. Again, what he found is that the accounts are very, very accurate, are not hallucinations in the way that we normally think about them. So don't we have to factor in the normal symptoms of anesthesia awareness?
In fact, anesthesia awareness takes a number of forms. There are many people who are aware during anesthesia who actually have clear consciousness and even what they would describe as improved consciousness. There is no problem there at all. In fact, these near-death experiences, they are actually expressing the effects of some of the effects of the anesthetic drugs, in particular the opiates, etc., and also low doses, perhaps of benzodiazepines. There's no problem there at all. In fact, not everyone during an awareness during anesthesia has a befuddled consciousness. They don't. I've had several people who were very aware during consciousness under anesthesia. They're administered by me. Even one person who had an out-of-body experience during which she clearly could describe the situation of the operating theater as she stood at the end of the operating table viewing everything as it happened during the nose operation. She was had clear consciousness and an out-of-body experience. Several patients have described, another patient also described an out-of-body experience to me at the beginning of a gynecological operation. She was so-called asleep. She was standing next to the table, legs in the holders, and the gynecologist, the anesthetist, "Can I begin?" And he said, "Yep." And she said, no, I'm not awake, I'm not asleep," and stood there next to it herself. So, in fact, these are effects of anesthetic drugs. And when you look at the effects of anesthetic drugs by several people, and I've administered anesthesia, many thousands of people, you can distinguish two types of people. One, those who find the effects of these drugs very pleasant and feel, yeah, wow, this is cool. And others who say, ugh, I don't feel so good. And so you've got a spectrum of reaction to these drugs. So, in fact, that some people have ecstatic experiences, they feel that their mental activity is faster than normal or just as good as normal, this does not surprise me one bit. I have seen these happen among people who are aware without any near-death experiences or out-of-body experiences. I've heard it from the people themselves. So that's not a big problem. In fact, that explains many of the mental states experienced by Dr. Long's patients. What he does describe in his book is that with his 23 patients, he compared them to the other 600 and whatever and did a chi-squared analysis, as he proudly describes, and found the only difference between their experiences and that of the other people was that they experienced more darkness. Well, I can explain that too. That's a fact of the physiology of the eye and a few other things. So there's no problem there. As I say, this brings us back to the point I made in the beginning, that the near-death experience can be considered a final common pathway. That means you have one experience. I often compare it to a headache. You got pain in your head. That can happen because you've got a cancer in your head eating it out, or you've got an abscess, a big sac filled with pus in your head and it's all inflamed, and you've got a headache, or you've got a big hole in your head because someone hit you with a rock, or you've got a migraine. Whatever the cause is, you have one thing, pain in your head, but the cause is different. So in other words, it's a bit like a near-death experience. You got near-death experience due to anesthesia, due to drugs, due to cardiac arrest, due to any one of a number of things. The final result is this experience.
Gee, that's interesting, because I think what Dr. Long was attempting to do by comparing the 23 cases that were under general anesthesia with the rest of the population was to say, not that here are the minor differences, but to say that there aren't many differences. So I think his point would be, we would expect that someone under general anesthesia, whether there's this awareness or not, they're heavily sedated, all these chemicals are coursing through their veins, we'd expect a different kind of conscious experience. We'd expect a reduced conscious experience, and we don't see it.
That's what he expects. But the thing is that he is not an anesthesiologist, and the experience of many anesthetists is that some people under anesthesia, if they have an awareness, is that they are fully aware and well able to describe everything and to have a clear consciousness. I've heard it once from a fellow who underwent a total extraction of all his teeth prior to undergoing heart surgery because he had rotten teeth, so that he could get rid of the bacteria, a source of bacteria which would infect his new heart valve before he underwent the operation. He underwent the operation, was perfectly normal during anesthesia, no problems, And at the end of the operation, when he woke up, he described, yeah, I was awake during the operation, heard everything clearly, felt good, didn't feel any pain, felt wonderful.
Okay, well, we'll leave that alone just in the interest of time for a minute, and especially since you're the expert on anesthesia. But I wanted to hit on a topic that we touched on just earlier, just very briefly, and that's this idea of the family reunion. And Dr. Long's point is that virtually all beings encountered during NDEs are deceased at the time of the NDE, and most are deceased relatives. And your response to that was, quoting from your paper, again, these meetings are either memories of the deceased or hallucinations. In any case, no one expects to meet living relatives after death, which is why they're absent in these stories. Now here, let me bring you to the, I'm going to try and make this go a little bit quicker by bringing you to the point. I think there's a bunch of assumptions wrapped in there, and I don't think the assumptions match up with the data. I mean, his data is that 95% of the folks that people encounter during a near-death experience are deceased friends or relatives. Why would we expect a hallucination to conform so closely to these kind of criteria? I mean, I fail to see how we could offer up some kind of physiological explanation for that.
No, you don't need to offer a physiological explanation, because people have these visions of deceased relatives. Sometimes they do not know them and later see them in these family photos. Leave that aside for the moment. But a person who expects to undergo a near-death experience, because there's a very interesting paper published by Grayson in 1985 in which he compared expected near-death experiences with unexpected. And what he found with the expected near-death experiences was that about a half of these people had what they you would call transcendental experiences. In other words, they meet deceased relatives, etc. Now, what they do is that they meet these deceased relatives very well, and they only meet deceased ones because in the land of the dead, they don't expect to see any living person. This is a cultural thing and something purely common sense. These people expect to meet their relatives in an afterlife. And so, of course, they do. And the form they see their relatives in is usually in a much improved form to what they were like when they actually had passed away. You wouldn't want to imagine that you came went to heaven with both legs amputated and walk around and roll around in a wheelchair. So they see their relatives improved, and they look good, and these relatives come to guide them. In fact, there's those cross-cultural studies reveal that, in fact, Americans tend to see relatives. People in other countries don't always see relatives.
Okay, then that brings up another point we can move on to. Again, because I think it's the same point I'm going to bring up when we talk about the cultural differences and the age differences. And just let me hit the high points, and that's that I don't think we can really expect, as you're suggesting, that these hallucinatory experiences would conform so closely to each other. You just mentioned the cultural differences. Again, he doesn't find cultural differences. The 95% of deceased friends and relatives that he finds crosses all cultures. It also crosses all age barriers. So even children as young as 3 who haven't been indoctrinated with this whole scenario of what's going to happen after you die, they're included in the data, and they still see the same hallucination. I mean, isn't it kind of like you're suggesting that since we all have a similar brain, we all have similar brain physiology, and we all dream, therefore we all dream the same dream, and we know we don't dream the same dream?
That's quite correct. We don't. But the thing is that when you're talking about children of 3 and 5, etc., there is always no one has actually seen the visions that they saw during their near-death experiences, and these children also do undergo near-death experiences as well. There is no doubt about that. Melvin Morse has done a whole pile of studies on this matter and has proven it beyond any doubt. Children do undergo these things. But the thing is, as with the adults, the observers, or the people who hear these reports, do not see these visions. And if a child reports seeing a person, they give a description of it, which is vague, and then expectation comes in to the hearers as well. So you actually cannot actually prove that they see the same relatives or the same types of relatives as an adult. An adult can express themselves better, but then there comes also a matter of expectation as well, and a bit of joining up the dots, as it were, in the case of the relatives they didn't recognize during their near-death experiences. In fact, children do see deceased persons, or persons they do assume are deceased during their near-death experiences, even for children of 3 and 5. But it does not automatically follow that the persons they say they saw are the ones they actually saw. I disagree with that.
Okay. Well, then let's hit the last point of our 9 points, and then hopefully we can wrap this up and leave a little bit room to talk at the end. And that's the final point in Dr. Long's book, is this changed lives. NDEers are transformed in many ways by their experience, and they're often transformed for life.
I think it's an interesting point as well. In fact, you can explain it very mechanistically, as well as psychologically. In a number of ways. One, extreme hypoxia or oxygen starvation does cause lasting changes in brain structure and function. For example, the pyramidal cells in the cerebellum, cells in the CA1 sector of the hippocampus, or the summer sector, whatever you like to call it, the large cells in the dorsomedial nucleus of the thalamus, these are very sensitive to the effects of hypoxia or oxygen starvation. In fact, during oxygen starvation, you notice in the frontal lobe, the EEG, or the electroencephalograph of the frontal lobes, suddenly develop delta activity, which is an indication that the thalamic, the brain circuits between the part of the brain called the thalamus and the frontal lobes no longer functions. There are many indications like this. And studies of people subjected to hypoxia, like mountaineers who climb above 5,000 meters without supplemental oxygen, they have brain function changes and mental changes and personality changes which last for 3 months to a year and even more. That's one aspect of the explanation. And 90% of all people undergoing an experience where they are nearly dead, epidemiological studies done by the World Health Organization show that 90% of them suffer oxygen starvation as a cause of their near-death experience. Okay, that's one explanation. The second is, these experiences are so profound and so emotionally loaded for the people who undergo them, and even as some people say, spiritual. Okay, I'm actually a devout humanist rather than a person who a believer. These are such profound experiences that they do have an effect upon their lives. These people have almost died. They know this, and they have undergone an amazing, a wonderful experience. Even supernatural, according to how they or however they like to view this. And this, a profound experience like this, does not depart and does have an effect upon people. For instance, major injuries, etc., or major life events, for instance, they do cause what is called a post-traumatic stress syndrome. And I'm not saying these people have a post-traumatic stress syndrome, but they do affect a significant proportion of these people. They make them reflect upon their lives. They make them think about how they have acted. And so they do cause changes. But these are changes either psychological changes due to reflection and thinking about what has happened to them, or a sort of post-traumatic stress disorder. And I'm not saying they have post-traumatic stress disorder. That's quite something quite different to what these people experience. But they have a psychological change do this. And secondly, there is the matter of the physiological effects of the episode that caused their near-death experience. And these are also possibly present. So it does not surprise me at all that many of these people do undergo a sort of life change, or a change personality, change attitude towards life, etc. Not at all surprising.
I hear you on that. I just disagree, and I think it's interesting because it circles us back to one of the earlier points that we talked about, and that's this gap and God of the gaps, or materialism of the gaps. And it's like, here's a case where we're trying to fill in a couple of huge gaps. I think the dots that you're kind of connecting are a little bit far apart, and moreover, I think there's a real easy way to get at the answer here. I mean, people suffer cardiac arrest or a brush with death, and then studies are done of them in terms of whether their lives are transformed. And then we can add in the variable of whether or not they had a near-death experience and see if their change is more dramatic and long-lasting if they had a near-death experience or if they didn't. So we don't really need to speculate here. We can just look at those studies, and I think those studies have been done.
Yes, indeed. By Pinvalomo, by Grayson, and in fact, they more or less support this as well. In fact, the near-death experience is life-changing, but you don't need a supernatural explanation for it. It is a profound experience, and profound experiences do change people.
Well, we'll look up those studies, because I think they're referenced, if I remember correctly, I think they're referenced in Dr. Long's book, and I think the results of those studies are that the brush with death doesn't significantly correlate with the change in life if it doesn't have the NDE, and the NDE is the deciding factor there. So anyways, that's a case where we have a gap, and I think we can fill it with the best research that we have at the time rather than speculation about, you know, what might be the psychological causes for people doing or not doing things.
I agree. But all the same, the near-death experience is such a profound experience that when you throw that on top of a cardiac arrest or another acute and very severe and possibly even life-threatening illness, you do have an effect upon the person. And I agree with that entirely. I think that that is reasonable and to be expected.
Well, Dr. Worley, you've done a terrific job for us of kind of addressing every one of these points. How would you sum up your case for a biological explanation for near-death experience?
I would like to sum it up in two things. One, my opinions on the book of Dr. Long, that I'm rather disappointed in it, because it does not advance the near-death experience research any further than it was 30 years ago, which is a shame, and because there has been a lot of research done on it. It doesn't advance it. I and several others have tried to find and formulate physiological explanations for all this. And in fact, there have been a lot of research done to explain various aspects of the near-death experience itself. Ultimately, when you look at the total body of evidence explaining the physiological or biological basis of the near-death experience, the out-of-body experience, and the other experiences that are reported by those undergoing near-death experiences, you come to the conclusion that most of them, in fact all of them, can be explained by body function and the changes in body function induced by the various, I call them stressors, or causes of the near-death experience, hypoxia, drugs, anxiety, and go on and on. And because, as I say, the near-death experience is not a unitary experience, or the cause is not unitary. And so, in my opinion, these experiences have been explained to be biological in basis, have a biological basis, and I do not think that Dr. Long or the Long's explanation or those of others who think that there is a more supernatural explanation, that they actually correspond with the facts. Why look for a supernatural explanation when a provable biological explanation is available? In fact, there are many things which can be done to demonstrate this. And in fact, unfortunately, many people performing near-death experience studies do not actually perform adequate statistical analyses to differentiate between the causes. I'd like to see more of that. But anyway, as I say, the cause, in my opinion, is biological rather than supernatural.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you very much for joining me. And more importantly, I hope that we can count on you to continue to engage in this dialogue, because what I've found is that it really takes a couple of rounds of going back and forth. One thing I'd like to do is go back and share with Dr. Long some of the details of your critique and hear his response. And then either by email or if you have the time, we'll try and connect with you again and see if we can really generate a full give and take on this topic.
I'd very much like to do that. And that sounds fascinating. And in fact, I'm sure that with a good deal of discussion and also exchange of information, more light can actually be shed upon this fascinating human experience.
Fantastic. Thanks again.
And thank you. I'm glad to have been here.
Thanks again to Dr. Worley for joining me today on Skeptico. As I mentioned earlier, Dr. Long has agreed to come back on and respond to some of these points, so I'm really looking forward to having this give-and-take exchange. I also think there's a couple of issues that I'd like to raise with some other medical experts, so I may be pursuing that in the future as well. In the meantime, if you'd like more information about this show, including a couple of the links that we talked about, including Dr. Worley's book that you can download and read for free, please visit the Skeptico website. That's at skeptiko.com. You'll also find links to all our previous shows, Facebook email links to me, a link to our forum discussion, and a bunch of other stuff. So that's going to do it for today. Much to come on future episodes of Skeptico. Until then, bye for now.